A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 13, 1997, in the series Tough Questions, No Easy Answers, entitled The Providence of God, Is It Wishful Thinking? The texts for the sermon are Genesis 37, verses 1 through 11, chapter 45, verses 1 through 5, and chapter 50, verses 15 through 21, and Romans 8, verses 28 through 39. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
The providence of God, that God upholds and governs all things in a rather direct and immediate fashion. The providence of God. Is it wishful thinking? That's a tough question. And there is no easy answer that I have to give to you. And that's the title of the series of sermons upon which we embark this morning. Tough questions, no easy answers. Tough questions, by that I mean not simply academic questions. Not questions that provide simply an intellectual gain. I mean questions that go to the heart and core of our being, questions that impact the way we live, how we live, with what comfort or lack thereof we live, with what strength or lack thereof we live, whether there is some guidance that enables us to follow for the fulfillment of the potential of our being. Questions that come to the core. Those religious questions, those questions that are the source of religion, all religions, struggling to understand the nature of our human experience, the nature of our world, and the nature of God. Tough questions, no easy answers. The providence of God. Is it wishful thinking? Is it the consequence of some deep primal need within us? Some need for security? Some need for certainty? Some solid place to plant our feet, some kind of safety, assurance, and guarantee, the providence of God. It does reflect a deep craving within the human person. The providence of God is probably as central as any faith conviction that I am aware of. I hear the providence of God brought to expression, whether the person knows it or not, by believing people and unbelieving people, by people who are pious and people who are secular, people who are righteous and people who are wicked. I hear coming out of the mouth of people in the pew and the people on the street over and over again in all of the diversity of life's light and darkness, I hear people say, tripping off their tongue, God had a purpose in it. God had a purpose in it. As though everything that happens is the consequence of the direct will of God, and whatever happens must be reflective of the will of God. And it no doubt derives from a deep, deep religious conditioning in our culture, but it has survived and gone beyond, as I said, to the average person on the street, At least in the West, God has a purpose in it. The providence of God. I've heard it expressed in the face of the most ghastly horrors. I've had it expressed in the presence of unmentionable tragedy. I hear it expressed sometimes, I think, as almost a denial of the darkness and the hurt and the pain. I hear it coming from one, obviously, who has not critically reflected upon it, but is responding almost involuntarily, almost spontaneously, as a conditioned response to the darkness, to the pain, and to all that can be so terribly wrong in human experience. God has a purpose in it. God makes no mistakes. Whatever God does well, etc., etc. There is, perhaps, no deeper human need than that sense of the providence of God. Maybe no deeper human longing than that conviction that God governs and upholds and is in control. Our tradition has been shaped by it. I put in your liturgy the questions and answers that deal with it from the Heidelberg Catechism. Questions and answers 27 and 28 come in that second part of the Catechism that deals with the Apostles' Creed. And it follows directly upon the question about the first article of the Creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. And then, what dost thou understand by the providence of God? The almighty and everywhere present power of God, whereby, as it were, by his hand, he still upholds heaven and earth with all creatures, and so governs them, that herbs and grass, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, meat and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty, yea, all things come not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. Upholds and governs, so that in human experience there is no chance. Everything is determined, and all things, light and shadow, come to us as from the fatherly hand of God. When I was a kid growing up, I think I would have chosen rather to swear in my father's presence, which I never would have done. But I might have chosen rather to swear in his presence than to say that somebody was lucky. Because there was no luck. Luck was almost, I can still feel it as a child, luck was a phrase or a word or a term that was used by those who didn't believe in God. And if I would say, Pop, let's go fishing tomorrow, he would say, God willing. And what is the profit of that kind of faith? Well, the next question and answer says that because of the providence of God in the control of all things, that nothing comes by chance, I may be patient in adversity, thankful in prosperity, and for what is future have good confidence in our faithful God. And I must say to you that some of the grandest piety that I have ever experienced has stemmed from lives that have lived with that kind of absolute trust. I have seen people patient in adversity, because they have accepted it as coming from the fatherly hand of God. I have seen people humble in the greatest success because they recognize that all was grace, all was freely given by God. And I have seen people live with confidence for the future because they believed that all things were in the hand of their faithful Heavenly Father. There probably is no stronger religious conviction to put iron in the backbone of a person, faith and hope in the heart, in every human experience than this kind of conception of an eternal God who in more or less direct fashion from the outside connects with, intervenes into, and is operative in the governance and the sustaining and the upholding and the caring for the creation that is apart from God. And it meets such a deep human craving and yearning and need. But knowing what we know about the nature of the universe and of the human person and of human society and of historical development, can we still believe it? Or is it really wishful thinking? And do we perhaps have a sense of that, and so we continue to spout it, almost numb to an honest appraisal of the data that overwhelms us in the human situation? Well, as I said, this conception of things comes out of a biblical model. And the fact that a conviction based on the model and understanding of reality that stems from the biblical times is a conviction that is based on a conception of things 2,000 to 4,000 years old. And it is not surprising if that which we might treasure deeply with all of our hearts comes in conflict with the mind, with reason, with intellectual survey of our situation. If that which we crave to believe and have been trained and conditioned to believe runs full square into the reality that we experience every day, that shouldn't surprise us, for all of our biblical stories are stories that come from a conception of things totally other than we have at present. On page 11 of your liturgy, I drew some lines which need to be perfected, but I was trying to show there in diagrammatic fashion the biblical model that sees God, the transcendent, holy other one, totally apart from this whole created reality, speaking the word that brings into creation, brings into reality the creation that is characterized by perfection, a paradise. And the human person also created perfectly in that paradise situation, put to the test, fails the test, so that we speak of the fall. And that is reiterated again and again in those first 11 chapters of Genesis until God starts an alternative strategy, calling Abraham and Sarah and binding himself to them with a covenant of grace, issuing eventually in the Exodus and Israel and Jesus and the church moving toward the New Jerusalem, the holy city, and paradise regained. That is essentially a biblical model of things. And you can see that creation is really simply the stage on which a salvation story is told. And the whole thing is to get right with this God from whom we have fallen, to be reconciled in order that we might be prepared for an afterlife, which is really the goal of it all. Creation and perfection, fall and redemption. That's the biblical model. And all of the biblical stories are modeled on that conception of things. But it's not the world we know. And the explosion of knowledge of the universe, of the human person, of society, of historical development, this is not the way things are. And I tried with some circles and lines on page 12 to give an expression to an alternative model, a creation model that I call it. The operative word there not being fall and redemption, but rather emergence. And stemming from that big bang, the explosion into expanding space and ever greater duration of time, a river of energy that coalesces into various diverse forms of matter and returns back again into energy, energy, matter, time, space, the nature of the cosmic reality as we know it today. And that 15 billion year process which began in the explosion at an inorganic level of the combination of chemicals and elements, moving to an organic level in the presence of life, moving to the human, to the conscious, self-conscious creature that we have become, being beckoned onward to spirit and the spiritual reality that we taste at times but fall from so often. And if you took God out of that page, if you took God as spirit, if you took divine breath out of that page, you would have a conception of the cosmos as it is understood by those who study these things, quite apart from religion or faith or God. That's pretty much the reality of which we are a part. It is a faith affirmation that I put down there, God as mystery, as the fount of creativity from which all flows. It is a faith affirmation that I add the words divine spirit as permeating that whole process. It is a faith affirmation that I see that process as tending towards spirit and ultimately toward a goal of shalom. All of that is my own faith imposition. But at least it is a faith imposition that is posited on a picture of the universe that is in accord with what we know about reality in our day. And so I raise the question whether or not this creation model of our understanding of our world, our universe, ourselves, whether given that, there might be some way in which we might still be able to affirm that which the scriptures at their core affirm, that we might still be able to have a sense of the presence of God and being a part of that larger reality that is moving according to a gracious purpose and intention. The providence of God, in other words, that precious doctrine, which we really can no longer understand as some God out there pulling strings and controlling things in here. That precious doctrine, which has meant so much to us, but which no longer reflects reality as we know it, and also has its own problems. Because for every person that I have seen, patient in adversity, I can name you another who lost their faith because they felt somehow or other demonized by this Heavenly Father's hand. It's one thing to glory in the providence of God when there is a marvelous healing. It's another thing to affirm it when a beautiful 5-year-old little girl is dying in this moment in spite of prayers. It is one thing to revel in the successes of history of our nation or tribe or ethnic group. It is another thing if you are God's elect people, Jewish people, wherein 6 million are fed to the flames of the oven. Then one cannot help but say, providence of God, that God I have experienced then as a devil. Is there some way, given what we know, honest with our human experience, is there some way yet to rest in God? The Joseph story is the classic biblical story of the providence of God. It is in the old model. But there is that in the story that we can capture, I believe, and find a way by which we might join in with the Spirit of God in that movement toward shalom and community. Joseph's brothers are scared to death that he'll do them in, and rightly they might fear. But he says to them, "Am I God?" Joseph recognized that he was not in the place of God, that he too was human, and with humility and grace forgave them, effecting reconciliation and moving toward community when he had it in his power to destroy them and increase the violence of the world. Joseph, in this story, forgives and reconciles and breaks the cycle of violence. And you see, in so doing, he joins in with whatever purpose of God may be discovered as a gracious purpose moving toward shalom. For the thing that this model of the universe has brought to our attention is the fact that God is not out there operating in a vacuum apart from us, but in the affecting of creatures like us, called on the scene co-creators. Co-creators who can dream the dream with God, or who can destroy the dream, who can move with God's intention and purpose toward shalom and community, or create violence and hell on earth, who can save the rainforest or despoil the earth, who can move toward world community or ethnic rivalry. God's dream will not be realized apart from us. Joseph, a co-creator with God, joined in the dream toward reconciliation and peace, and with humility and grace forgave his brothers. And Paul, as responsible as any biblical writer, I suppose, for this old doctrine of the providence of God. But Paul perhaps can be understood as well as saying that God, in terms of the new model, permeating the totality of reality, life-giving, sustaining, creative, moving it on, beckoning it towards shalom, the God who perhaps has mystery, fount of creativity, loading the dice toward peace, loading the dice of the universe toward grace, could be understood differently than Paul did, and yet, I think, genuinely, as working together all things for our good. joining the dream? Could we not say, God is for us? To the extent as co-creators with God, centers of self-conscious being, decision-making, acting, creating, affecting, if that dream of peace through grace lives within us, can we not rest in the assurance that God is for us, and that come what may, that divine intention will be realized? We can thwart it, we can destroy it, but it will not finally be frustrated or killed, because it is in the very structure of things. It is in that cosmic process that continues to move, to expand, and to find constantly new creative forms in an infinite potential that is being actualized in an amazing and wondrous fashion in this world that ought to take our breath away. This world in which we are not simply passive observers, but actors in the drama. And if God is for us, then can we not say that nothing will separate us from that love? For that love and grace and goal of shalom has been defined as the mystery came to concretion in the face of Jesus. And it is Jesus to whom Paul says we are predestined to be conformed. In other words, if I hear Paul and if I put it in this new creation model, then can't I say that there is some kind of divine impetus, some kind of breath of God, some spirit of God, some loaded dice thrown in this cosmic process that is always moving it toward the human, toward the humane, toward the global, toward community, toward reconciliation and love and peace. If that's the nature of this drama in which we are caught up, then are we not constantly put before the test, as was Joseph, to whether or not we will be bearers of the dream, purveyors of the spirit, or undercut it for our own selfish purpose? Are we not finally called to become like Jesus, conformed to His image, whose highest moment was when He was willing to die for His dream, whose ultimate expression was, "Thy will be done"?